Welcome back to Pod on the Parish. I cannot believe it. We're at episode 8 now. We've got Tom Sykes with us today. So Tom, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, very well. It's like almost a sunny day, but I also got hailed on a way back from a site visit. So, you know.
How many site visits do you do a week?
Probably, we've got one project on site in town here. So we're probably down there once a week. And then we've got another project on site in London, where they're once a fortnight or once a month.
Okay, cool. So site visits, tell me more. Yes. What do you actually do for your job?
I'm an architect. Oh yeah, that would have been a useful thing to open with, wouldn't it? Like, why is this guy turning up on site? I'm an architect and I run a small practice here in Stroud in Gloucestershire. And the work we do is mostly with community organisations and public sector clients. So the two projects where we are going to site to see the contractor putting things together and making these buildings are a council office and community hub for Stroud Town Council, which is a retrofit of an old doctor's surgery. Let's get the I'm gonna tilt it and all the furniture is gonna fly out, but there's a model that we're sort of using.
Tom is showing a model of his of the town council
of the space
For those of you on the podcast, it looks very impressive. Thanks. Looks like you enjoy getting handy. So that wasn't a AutoCAD or 3D model, that was a physical model.
It's great, isn't it? I mean, because you're not with me, but when you're with me, you can like look down the corridor and see all the little people that we put in there around the furniture. I think it takes so long to go from the idea of a building to be able to walk into it finished. And we need a hand thinking about what that space looks like, but I think everybody needs a hand. So it's those little things that you can do to get people inside a project or imagine what that transformation is going to be before it's happened and make it worth their while.
So how long does it take you? I mean, obviously, it's how long is a piece of string, but what are your tools and how long does it take to build that physical model? What's it made of?
That's made of foam board and card, and then a few other sort of cute bits and pieces. Like, we get little model people. It's all to the scale, which is a strange thing to say, but like 1 millimeter on that model is 50 millimeters in real life. And that model was made by a graduate architect who was with us doing some work experience.
Oh, that's perfect.
Working with the project lead on that project. And we use it to test ideas, like, is this space the right height and depth? If we put this furniture in, how does it affect it? If we add some color here, does that highlight make the space feel more legible or feel more welcoming? All those kinds of things.
And it's also fun because we have like such digital and office jobs now, to have that aspect, that practical aspect of it also is
One of our favorites is we've just been shortlisted for a housing design award for a housing project in London, and we've got the model, and it's on the window, so it's quite big, but the sun comes in and it is facing the right way, so as the sun comes around the afternoon, you see what the sun would do in the courtyard and how it cuts through that building.
Oh, that is so cool.
Lovely. And we sit there imagining, not that we ever take enough time to go for drinks on a sort of 4 p.m on an afternoon, but we imagine that'd be a lovely spot to go and have a drink in there.
True. So beyond being an architect, is there something about you that most people don't know? Have you got like a hobby, side hustle, or anything you want to share?
I'm a magician.
Oh, is it? That is nice.
Yes. I paid for my studies by doing magic in bars.
Oh, really? Okay, cool.
So I'd wander around tables doing close-up magic and generally trying to get paid by the establishment rather than trying to hustle for tips, because I found that hard. But
So you're still doing that as a side hustle, or is
very occasionally? And I've got a 2.5-year-old who already knows that it's actually in the other hand, daddy. That's pretty annoying, but still bits and pieces.
That's cool. How much am I allowed to ask? How much does a magician get when they attend an event?
It's quite a lot. I was working, I had a residency in a restaurant in London for 5 years, and so I was charging £150 for a sort of long lunchtime period. Uh-huh. I think that's probably quite low for magicians now, attending, like, you know, doing a big wedding might be several £100, but
Excellent. Yeah, so today we're going to be talking about procurement outcomes, transitioning from magician.
Neatly done.
procurement outcomes. We've got quite a few people. Yeah, I think, did I have a look here? We've got in the webinar today, which we'll join in a second. We've got 128 sign-ups. So that'll be a mixture of town and parish councils. I imagine it's going to be a few more town councils, large councils in there. But what's one, in terms of like the topic, what is one common mistake you see within your industry?
I think it's probably to do with proportionality. A lot of smaller parishes adopt standard templates for standing orders, and in their financial one, they might have some procurement guidance, and it might say something along the lines of, very literally, an example of a client we're working with: if it's over £500, get three quotes. And for any service that's beyond, I don't know, buying something quite small, that's getting a quote is quite a lot of work for the parish. But preparing a quote is quite a lot of work for all the suppliers that have to do it. And by the time you're thinking about an architect and talking to them, you're going to be spending tens of thousands of pounds on this stuff by the end. If you're getting three quotes right at the beginning, you said you might just need someone to help you write a brief. Their quote might be £2,000 to do that. You don't want to have to go through a whole procurement exercise just to have
Yes.
that conversation properly and record something. So I think it's take a look at those standing orders in terms of what you're actually doing with them and work out if there's a more proportional way of doing it.
Yeah, the financial regs, but yeah. Okay, cool. Well, let's jump on over to the webinar, and also I'll catch up with you afterwards to ask you a few more questions. Anyway, let's jump in.
Perfect. Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Cool. Okay. I mean, I think the big question immediately is this session just going to be incredibly boring because it's about procurement? And I suppose it might be. I really hope it's not too bad, but we'll see how we go. Look, jargon aside, my dream is that of the things that I talk about today, you already know loads of it, but there are three or four little nuggets that are useful, and that this talk gives you a little bit of get up and go on the next procurement exercise to do something interesting and useful with it. I also should say, like, having spent quite a lot of time preparing this talk, I really want another word for procurement already. So we'll workshop that at the end. We'll find something more interesting than just procurement. So, what is this talk really about? It's the first substantial stage of a professional relationship between you and your council and an organisation. It's about relationships. You're going to use these relationships to get the right thing for you, for your team, for your councillors, and for your communities, which is really hard every time because you can't always do the thing that you want to do. Otherwise, you'd probably just be doing it yourself. You don't know 100% the outcome you want. You might not know every step of that's involved. And there are some really unscrupulous people out there trying to take you for a bit of a ride. So you don't know who necessarily is right. And it's always about value. And this is normally shorthand for cheaper. And I just want to start there because I think that's quite a useful place to start. Say you're furnishing community space for your new building. You need a sofa and a couple of chairs. What do you end up with? Like something A in the budget range looks like the nicer ones, but it's not as comfy. Like looks welcoming, but isn't. Something in the low mid-range, maybe it comes with a warranty, it's soft but hard wearing, looks welcoming, probably is, or some like super fancy Eames chairs from Denmark, like really nice. And what do you want? And what do you think will be the right ones? And which are the ones you're most likely to end up with? And I suppose I want to talk about getting to B, because I think that's probably the right answer, but we all face the risk that we might end up at A. This morning I'm going to run through a lot of things. When I wrote the title for this session, I didn't quite realize how much there was to say to be comprehensive. But hopefully, even though I'm going to say a lot, this set of info will be useful to you next time you do procurement. I'm going to talk about best practice, and it may sound like it's more work adding to what I'm sure are already overflowing plates, but I promise you it's not adding too much, and in the long run will save you a lot of time. And hopefully these slides are also a useful set of prompts. So we'll start with some fundamentals. We'll move on to talking about finding suppliers, then writing tenders, then evaluating quality, cost, and then some final thoughts. Today, I'm going to focus on the more complex procurement types, so services and works and partners, rather than goods or simple supply and utilities. I'm going to show you examples of tender documents that are at that sort of scale, but the lessons, just pare out the stuff that feels much of too much. Right, before we really begin, I'm just going to say who I am and why I care about this so much in the background of our practice. So I'm the founder of CommonWorks. We're an architecture practice that works with communities and public sector clients to make places that build community and spark a sense of connection. So on a day-to-day basis, we might be doing things like making a community growing garden in the street, built and designed in a weekend, making a multi-generational community space on a background plot that sort of nestles into nature, helping Stroudtown Council transform their offices into a community hub with nature at its heart, or designing whole new community centres in the middle of existing communities, looking at master plans for larger open spaces and how parishes can make the most of their assets, to community housing, creating wonderful new homes on small infill sites. We've just been shortlisted for a housing design award this one, which is so exciting. Some of these are complete as well, affordable workspaces with railway arches, design codes and guides, even a learning kitchen in a community hub, so making space for a community to get together and make and share food. Basically, any space which needs a team sensitive to the needs of communities come to us. I've also been an expert for the Design Council and a design review panelist for Design West. But what puts me here is, as John said earlier, I was head of design for Transport for London's property team, so dealing with housing and mixed-use schemes on over 5,000 hectares of land across London. When I turned up there, there were no quality standards. Cost was king. And you could tell that in the work that was being produced. So I spent 4 years shifting the culture and the practices of the team from setting design principles, sustainability standards, community engagement tools, to running tenders and procurement exercises. And the lessons that I'm going to talk about come from this side. So working client side with a legal and procurement team, but also with developers. And it may sound strange when I say it like this, but when I was there, seeing the procurement of design teams and development partners, at the very start of it, I was made to feel quite out of place for being interested in the idea of quality, or if we're commissioning architects, what a place might be like in 25 years' time, rather than the deal that was in front of us. But I think that's what good stewardship is about in the public sector. And so that's the kind of frame I want to put this in. Okay, we'll start with some quick fundamental holding thoughts, financial thresholds, cost of tendering, that kind of stuff, how to get good quotes. But it is worth saying there is a whole Procurement Act 2023. It's a re and you might want specialist advice and legal stuff. The Act is big guns, big money. I'm going to focus on smaller, more nuanced things, but just so you know right now, there is a whole big government thing out there. Thresholds. Useful to know these. Basically, at what contract value do you need to do what overall process? When do you have to do the all singing, all dancing procurement? Look yours up and make sure they're proportionate and know that you can work with them when needed. So with the Government Act, for services, you can direct award someone up to £215,000 without procurement. And for construction works, you can go to just over 5 million. Now, you'll probably end up being lower. You'll have standing orders or financial requirements that have lower thresholds. And there are reasons why you might, but it is worth being proportionate. Sometimes those thresholds are getting in the way of you doing your job. One council we work with requires 3 quotes for anything over £500. And this is really hard. It's making a lot more work for the clerk in that place. And for all of the people who they go to, suddenly they're having to do a day or two's work to put a quote together for something that might only be worth a couple of thousand pounds. If you want better text for standing orders, we've been drafting some that is proportionate to the type of work you're procuring. And feel free to email me and share that. The other thing I want to think about in that vein is the cost of tendering. I'm sure you've often thought about this, like, what is the actual cost of me going through this process? Firstly, for you, I suppose do a rough guess of the time involved, and then what we have to do is always double it because we end up thinking about things too hard. And that would be about right. It's always more work, and it's always important to do it right and not rush. And rather than think about it as deliverables, I find it easier sometimes to think about what you might need to get signed off and put some time against each of those. So you need to get the overall principle of the thing signed off, the approach you want to take, the brief, the scoring methodology, the people who you're going to, the budget you have available, finding funding, the assessment panel, assessment decisions. It's a lot. And that's before you get into variations and get going. Equally, on the other side, responding to tenders costs time and money. So, just looking back at the last few tenders we have done, where it's been a shortlist or from a framework, we spend on average £4,000 to £8,000 a time preparing these bids for contract values that are between £40,000 and £80,000. So, we're spending almost 10% upfront in the hope that we win. Now, we normally do win because we're really careful about what we enter. But for big companies who predominantly win work this way, it gets terrifying. A large firm of architects can spend £10,000 to £12,000 on these bids. They'll be larger projects, but still, they'll only have an expectation of winning 1 in 10. So if you appoint a bigger company on a framework, then a load of their fee is paying for the cost of the 9 other exercises they didn't win. Which brings me to the big question that I do want to park in your brains. Do you need to tender at all? These are my reasons to and not to. So the reasons to tender. You have a clear brief. You either don't know which supplier would be best, or you have a shortlist of a few who would be really good. You know how you would be able to tell who a good supplier is for you. You know broadly the outputs and know that people tendering can understand and respond to them, and you have the time and resource to run the exercise. You're sure about your budget and that it's sufficient, and the expected budget is beyond those thresholds. I guess if the reason is the last one, then you definitely need to go back to the top of this list and make it your to-do list, or sort out your thresholds. But there are reasons not to tender. If you're not sure of the final scope, if you aren't 100% about how to choose a good supplier, if you don't have a market-tested budget for the work, if you're not certain the contract would go ahead, or you're not sure who you would go to, or you know exactly who you would like to go to, if there are any doubts in your mind, then hopefully these 2 little bits are helpful in deciding whether or not you should tender. Even if you don't tender and you just build a brief and work it out with someone, the rest of this talk will still be useful because it will still set a good foundation for that. So single source and best value, 2 more points here. Often the reason for tendering work is to allay concerns about best value. Asking the market to compete for work is seen as a quick way of guaranteeing best value, but I'm sure we've all experienced that this isn't always the case, and there are other ways around this. When you're worrying about costs, what you're really worrying about is resource. You're not normally paying more because a consultant is making more profit. You're paying more because they're spending more hours on the project. A cheap fee simply means someone is doing it quickly, and maybe too quickly. And honestly, we find if we haven't had to tender, we work quite a lot harder because we feel like, oh, they're probably wishing they'd tender. We should really show them how good we are. So how can you demonstrate best value without going out for procurement? You could ask a consultant to prepare an outline scope and some service options. In a way, this is almost the same as getting three quotes. So as an example, this is a fee we prepared for a client for an early piece of work. And it shows you what it shows you is the key outcome, a master plan for a public realm space. It can be achieved in a million different ways. We could do a bare bones approach with the key drawings, or we could make that work focused around internal or external stakeholders, or we could go out to the community. We try and list out the deliverables we'll provide to support you as a client in the hope that you're then able to make a more informed decision. And it's not just, to do this feasibility costs £7,000. It's, we can get it done for four, but actually some of these other services are going to be really valuable to us. What we hope as suppliers is that you look at this and come back to us, ask us a question, make a hybrid option, negotiate on the fee. Which brings me to my final point in these fundamentals. You are in a position of awesome power. People want to work with you, and they really want you to be an informed and engaged client. We kill for clients that come back and ask questions, ask for a detailed proposal. It gives us a chance to talk about how we can work with them best. So what I'm saying is that if you've got any thoughts or questions or ideas about services you want, just ask. Good suppliers will be delighted to talk to you about them. Which is a nice segue into finding these suppliers. I think there are three main ways of doing this. Frameworks, contract finder, or like punching out into the internet, or finding your own suppliers. Frameworks are pre-curated list of potential providers accessed through a management company. They can be amazing. The procurement process is mapped out for you. Someone does a lot of the legwork. The potential partners are pre-selected, and in theory, they're relevant. And the thresholds will be clearly set, and they're probably higher than the ones that you have in your standing orders. They come with certain guarantees. All the suppliers will have been checked from multiple angles, ISO 9001 insurance, environmental policies, and sometimes previous projects, social value, diversity. There are a couple of downsides, though. First, all that due diligence is red tape, time, and effort. And smaller suppliers can't afford to do that or won't actually meet the requirement of it, even if the requirement doesn't guarantee their performance. So if you want smaller local suppliers, the odds are they aren't on a framework. The other side is that, generally speaking, the people who sell the services frameworks, I hope they're not listening, but I find sometimes morally they're in grey areas. They're going to promise you the earth. Oh, it's such an interesting project you want done. This is exactly, we have a panel of suppliers. They're perfect for this. Let's go. But do they? On a project for TfL, our client has gone through two failed procurement exercises for a contractor because the frameworks selected by their advisors have been the wrong ones. And after 4 or 5 months of effort by us and our client, we've not had a single response from the suggested panel. So if you plan to use a framework, these are my top tips. Quiz the provider. Which lot is best? What's the percentage success rate from putting out the tender to signing the contract? Find out how suppliers get onto the framework. Is it competitive, or do they just have to fill in a form? Get a detailed list of all the things they need from you, and if possible, ask for a previous set of good tender documents from a similar type of project. Make sure you're clear on how the pay framework work is paid for. Is it an additional cost that you need to find? And then look up the suppliers on the suggested lot. See if you like them. Make sure you hold a supplier event, agree a program with the framework provider, and set your own version of what success looks like. A signed contract may be enough, but maybe you want additional support in the process. Option two, just get it out there, write a tender, put it on Contracts Finder, wait for responses. Generally speaking, this is the least good way of commissioning work because you have no idea who will read the tender or how they will respond. As a minimum for doing this, I would try and find a few suppliers and prime them, or use Contracts Finder or similar to run an expression of interest. That way, you can do a light approach to start with and then have a more focused shortlist for the full tender. When they're out and they're live and they're not big sums, a lot of small practices won't even bother looking at them because they'll assume that they'll just be picked up by the big commercial outfits. And so you end up getting people self-select them out themselves out of doing this work. Option three, curate your list. So this is building a short list of suppliers who you know are skilled enough and getting them to tender in a controlled, competitive way. This has always been my preferred way to do things. But to do it well and demonstrate best value means being super clear on your requirements and having good knowledge of your potential suppliers. But those are really the reasons why I think it's so good. So the first thing is you're going to have to upskill in what you're asking for. Get to know the suppliers who produce it. And this work makes you better as a client and will mean the outcome you get is better. For any single service, there are probably hundreds of suppliers who could do the work well. But you don't need all of them to tender. You just need a few who meet maybe additional requirements around social value or environmental policies. It's also a great way to start building relationships and your network. And this will make all the other stuff I'm going to talk about next easier because these people, they may be your supplier, but they're also your sounding boards. You can search professional body websites by area to get lists, or you can use word of mouth. I'm just going to quickly focus on one more interesting route for finding these people. Invite them to meet you. If you know you've got a few projects coming up in the next 4 or 5 years, then email all the local practices, invite them to a session where they can meet you and maybe some of your team and hear about what you're up to. This will self-sort those suppliers into those who feel their skills could be valuable to you, and then it'll give you a chance to meet a number of people. To ease the competitive pressure, it could be good to invite a couple of different disciplines, so not just a room full of architects, because it gets very weird. And the more council reps that are there, the better, so there's a chance to talk. You could invite everyone to leave a project sample with you, or you could show them a timeline of what you think is going to happen, talk about possible contract values, and then be ready to have some follow-up conversations. The other thing is that you're likely to have a few consultants who you already work with. This may seem obvious, but have a review of what's working, what isn't, what skills are missing, or even what parts of the professional relationship are missing, so that you can be clear about what you want from future consultants. Or the other way around, establish who you haven't worked with, small practices, local practices, or diverse practices. Okay, we're getting into like putting the tender together now. Let's imagine we know what we want. And we know how we're going to find consultants. Now we need to put the document together, the things that everyone's going to respond to. I'm going to try and structure this in a way that you can just nick my headings as your own, then adapt it and prepare. Think of this as taking out the blank page and giving you a more nuanced strategy than anything ChatGPT could give you. So the basics of what you need: boring things, relevant council policies, as much survey and existing information as possible, and a sample contract or just name of a standard contract. Then the fun stuff, the brief. The qualitative scoring breakdown, which is part three of this talk, and the quantitative part, which is part four. I'm not going to talk about the boring stuff. I want to focus on the juicy bits and how to make them work for you. This part is going to focus on the brief, and then we go to scoring. So I'll show you my headline contents alongside a worked example: the procurement of an architect-led design team for the refurbishment of part of Transport for London's Arch estate. My headline contents are introduction, background, project brief, program, and then some attachments. The introduction: who you are and what the role is. One paragraph, just one paragraph. Background: any relevant history or work. So here we talked about the project's location, the demographics of the area, which was fundamental to working with the communities, the planning history, aspirations, a quick, very high-level set of aspirations, and the team, who on the client side is involved and what skills that they'll be bringing, so your suppliers know how to dovetail with those. Do you have a fundraiser who's going to be available one day a week for the project, and who the team need to meet with, that kind of thing. Then the project brief. This wants to be short and comprehensive. So I recommend doing it in layers so the bidders can see what the priorities are and where they come from. I would start with your core values and how they apply to this project. Then the project-specific ambitions. So for a place-shaping project, I'd always try and state these as social and spatial ambitions. The project outputs, the specific minimum deliverables you know you'll need. In this one, we set it against the RIBA work stages. The hard bit, it is hard, is knowing what to include at this stage, but I will come on to that. Any other specific bits? There was a potential here for some funding that we wanted to tap into, so we share details of this with the bidders. Then the appointments required. So if you're looking for more than one supplier, say you need an architect and you want them to come with a structural engineer and an electrical engineer, this is a bit where you tell them who to bring. Any policy or project context, any additional allowances, so crucial for highlighting areas where you've already identified a bigger risk or requirements that you'll place on the consultants. Program. There should be two parts to the program. The program for the tender, which should cover the procurement, so a supplier workshop, clarification deadlines, response deadlines, and your planned assessment period, perhaps also including interviews. And the ideal proposed delivery program. So this could cover things like start on site or start of services, funding deadlines, planning targets, maybe even key dates for sign-off meetings like council meetings. As in how much time you need at each stage to sign things off, do you need a presentation and then 2 weeks to share with councillors and then pass back comments? That's kind of useful stuff. So when the consultants prepare a program, it's responding to you. And attachments, as much info as you can give them. We had a vision document, very scrappy, that we prepared internally, but it kind of helped set the tone for the project. Again, I'm sure a lot of what I've just gone through, you know, so I want to focus on how you know that you've got a good brief that people will be able to respond to. The easiest answer is to test it with a possible consultant or two. They're the people who are responding to this stuff all the time, and their advice will be exactly what you need. Start with a skeleton brief, what you need, and then ask your friendly supplier questions about what they would need in order to return a good, clear, and competitive tender. You can use this to ask them about timescales or the kinds of deliverables or how to structure them, timings for the tender period, or the kind of deliverables that they would want to put back as a tender to help you get a good answer and then build it out. This end, I want to touch on the biggest mistakes in preparing the main brief and how to avoid them. So, too many documents, you don't know where to look first. Documents prepared by different teams end up having conflicting information. If other teams or other people have to contribute, make sure there's a hierarchy of contributions, and if possible, integrate the information yourself. Too long. The document is too long. The trouble with length is that suppliers are more likely to miss things, even important things, and that as you go through your approvals, you might miss things or accidentally build in conflicts. Short and sweet is best. Unrealistic or binding programs. This just puts people off responding, as they feel like if they came back and said, ah, that's not really enough time to do this properly, they just get excluded. So one way around this is to put an indicative date in with suppliers to propose their own program, and you'll be scoring their program, but for completeness and rigor, not how well it aligns with your targets. Inconsistent description of deliverables. Only state deliverables in one place in the document. Ambiguous priorities of the client. As a supplier, we really want to know what matters to you so we can provide a service that really fits that and puts it front and center. Who are you as a client? What makes you tick? Is it your climate target? Is it getting social value through the project? Is it using local suppliers? It can be a council-wide thing or project specific, but it's really good because it gives suppliers or good suppliers something to respond to and hang on to, and also something that bad suppliers will miss, and then you can kick them out. The final thought I have on this section, a bit weird. You're going to write this as if it describes a project you want to do. Like, you're thinking about this building that's going to be there for 50 years, but your suppliers are going to read it as a tender that they have to respond to in quite a short period of time. Yes, they'll end up delivering that building, but any reasonably sized project is going to take months or years to deliver, and it's going to evolve. What you want is a brief that allows the best supplier to shine and come forward, and someone you can evolve a relationship and a project with. So have this in mind whilst you're writing. What would I want to tell someone about the idea of this project so they can show me why they would be good to work with on it? Okay, now we go to the scoring that response, subliminal messaging. Evaluating quality. This is the bit where you ask them to respond and show why they would be perfect for you. There are three golden rules. Don't ask for too much work. If you want ideas, pay for them and set page limits. Don't be too exclusive. It makes suppliers think there's already someone in the frame. And give clear guidance. Suppliers want to know how to answer well, so ambiguous questions or unclear scoring systems make it hard to respond well. And think about how you're going to assess. What does a good answer look like to you? Like, think about that when you're even writing those questions. There are three things that a technical submission can ask for. Give us a design or a proposal, in which case pay an honorarium. Tell us about your method for delivering, or show us you can do it by using a previous project. I would say pick one of these and prioritize it. It's the best way to keep the responses comparable. If you do ask for all three of them, make them separate questions and weightings. If you ask an open-ended question that seems to be about all three, you will have a nightmare with your assessment panel because no one will quite know what they're really wanting. Let me just highlight which method is best suited for which different type of project. My general attitude is not to ask for a proposal for three reasons. The consultant will rush it. They've just got that tender period, so it won't be their best work. You haven't had a proper chance to collaborate with them, so it's unlikely the supplier will get to the right answer. And you'll end up picking the best design, but not necessarily the best team. So going back to our trio, let's map them against the type of project they're best for. Where you're looking for an idea and you can pay for it, like it's basically a beauty contest, be extra careful how you judge it. This could be something like a fancy new landmark or an artwork or maybe a development partner. It applies best, but with big caveats, to design things where you want someone's vision without you being much of a part of it. Where you know the kind of thing you want, but are not sure about the best way of getting there and want to find suppliers who can guide you and share your values, this is the way to do it. This could be something like a new building or a public space. It applies best to design and consultancy skills where you know there will be a process and you want to have an active involvement in it. It can work for construction too when there's something unusual like community engagement. Where you know pretty much exactly what you want because you've seen one before and you want someone to repeat their work, this can be fine. This could be something more generic like adding an accessible WC to a building or putting in a lift. The weighting works best for construction works or specialist engineering. It's less good with design stuff. So I'm going to share my structure for route two, the methodology-based questions, because in most cases, this is the best one to go down. You need really good reasons to go the other routes. To make it simpler, I'm going to use the same example and show you where you can adjust it to make it specific. And I should say, I'm really happy to take questions on this, either at the end of the talk, over lunch, or just an email. All I want in the world is great places delivered by great clients. So keep the number of questions they have to respond to short, maximum four, and you can subdivide them if you need to. So methodology, design priorities, ask them to repeat the brief back to you. What do they think is important to you in their own words? And can they reframe it in an intelligent way? Client specific, how can they make what they do specific to you as a client? You want to give them a good clue or two in the brief, but you're looking for them to repeat that back. Key risks and mitigations. What are the risks for a project like this, and how would the supplier deal with them? This is such an important question. It's a chance to see if the consultant can be a good guide to the process and help spot potential obstacles. And something for your team. So in this Kilburn project, we had a really great planning officer in-house. So we added a question on their approach to planning, but this could be something around social value or community engagement or sustainability. There's an option here. You wanted them to use their previous work to show why they would be a good fit. Either you can ask for case studies of similar or relevant projects as a standalone part, or you can simply ask them to answer the above questions with reference to previous projects. There's no right answer, but make sure it's one or the other. Program. Get them to give you a program. The best programs will look like this. I'm not going to zoom in, but it's clear, like graphically it flows. Ask for commentary. Look for responses that highlight the key pressure points, client sign-offs, monitoring or assumptions. Team and people, the best answers will include your structure in their response. That's the council there. This is our design team. A resource chart. I love this one. It's so weirdly amazing and so good for comparing bids. I mean, obviously you're not comparing bids, you're scoring them independently, but when you compare them, this is great. In order to price a project accurately, we sit down and work out how long every member of the team is going to be working on the project, how many hours of work, by who. So this one deliverable is our way of showing you how we're adding value. If you compare the cheapest against the best, this chart is often the best proving ground for why the best will take the time to do the job properly and just do it once well. CVs, don't ask for loads, ask them to be made relevant. Equality, diversity, and inclusion, or social value-based. The key thing here is to be realistic about the scale of your project. It's also important that any elements in here are costed potentially separate. There may be amazing social value opportunities like financially supporting a community champion to train and be a client advocate. But suppliers won't want to suggest that awesome idea if it's something that would make them uncompetitive in the pricing section. Scoring these elements, please borrow the scoring system. You need a minimum of five because virtually no one will get the outstanding. So you need two types of good. You want two below this so you can argue about quality, and a fail is a fail. I tend not to put these out of 100 because you all get percentages floating around in our heads, and it makes excellent look unachievable because when was the last time you got over 80% in a test? And draft the text that goes with this. This is my draft for good, and you need to write something like this for all levels. A couple of other top tips. One of the overlooked things here is practice answering it yourself. Supplier created submissions, ask for them to do a PDF. Don't give them your own forms because the forms always break. Set page numbers. If it's text, maximum two sides of A4, size 11 font. If you want graphics, go to four sides, keep the font size. Allow landscape or portrait. The odds are you'll review this on your laptop, so it's actually really easier in landscape. Think about whether you'd allow additional documents or appendices. I would say generally no, unless you've only got a few bidders, otherwise you'll never finish reviewing it. And don't give too many pointers or clarifying notes. If the original question isn't short and clear, then you need to rewrite the question. Here's a terrible example. Paragraph one says you might collaborate with other suppliers. Paragraph two asks about communication with clients and stakeholders. The bullets cover tools of communication feedback and applying it to design. But what is the actual question about? Is it about collaborating with your peers or clients or community groups or statutory authorities or all three? Really hard to answer. Evaluating cost. Don't. I think that's a big thing I want to put in your head. Don't evaluate cost. Just tell people how much you want them to put. You should know already how much you want to spend on this project of yours. If you don't, you can find out how much you should be paying by getting the works costed by a quantity surveyor, benchmarking it with another authority, or asking suppliers directly what sort of fee they think is about right. So if you're looking for consultancy work, not construction, which is different, then I think you can pretty safely tell everyone what your budget is or how much you've allowed. That way, you're then assessing how well the suppliers will resource this project, not who can deliver the deliverables with the least work. Because all you're doing with consultants is buying their time and skill. The less you pay, the less you get of each of those two things. But it's kind of a hard sell. So you should score two elements. First, what you would expect, the overall price of the work. The second part is to do with the cost of each unit of time. You can either do this as rates, like pounds per director per day or effort days. You can measure these in a number of ways. For an absolutely killer review of the mechanisms, that QR code will take you to a good document. For the purposes of today, I'm going to touch on the wrong way and what is normally the right way. The wrong way is lowest price. The right way is deviation from mean. I did my first draft of this talk with spreadsheets and charts to explain this step by step. It's totally fascinating to me, but there isn't time, and I don't want you to hate me quite as much as my wife did when I presented it to her twice. The battle of the method is summarized mathematically in this chart. Lowest price is the red line. If you've got the lowest price, you get 100% of the score, and then there's maths about what everyone else gets along there. It assumes that less is more, that good things come from everyone sharpening their pencils. Deviation from mean, the average price is found, and then the closer a bid is to that price, the higher its score. It assumes that people price services realistically, knowing that everyone does the same. They'll come back with roughly the same answer, and the outliers are either being greedy or they haven't understood the project. It's not that lowest price is necessarily a bad way to score, it's just what it does to the numbers. So the cheapest bid gets 100% on the cost element, but the best quality bid will never get 100% on the quality side. You can easily find the bulk of bids scoring in the 60s or 70s because one mad bastard put in a low or really low fee. And suddenly, these other suppliers are looking for 20 or 30 points on the quality side, which is almost impossible. So I'm not going to run through this, but on the average price one, you end up getting a cost that's in the middle, not too low, not too high, but they've got a really good quality score all the way across. Where you're scoring the cheapest bidder with a really terrible quality score still wins. I have to say that I don't really think there is a place for lowest price tendering, even on construction contracts. With more flexible procurement environments, commercial or private projects, we often advise going with a middle or second contractor as they've usually provided a higher quality return. The final thing to say about cost is how you weight it overall. There is maths here. I'm really happy to share tender documents that we've prepared for other councils and other clients so that you can just have the maths for that deviation from mean, and I can show you some more examples if you're unsure or need to explain it to councillors. The final thing to say about cost is how you weight it overall. The answer to this is to think about two things. How certain are you about the final deliverables and what is required to provide them? And how important is a competitive cost to you? Take them one at a time. If you know exactly what the deliverable is and how to deliver it, then you can prioritize cost because you're not asking suppliers to show you how they will do it. That's why construction contracts normally weight cost highly. The works information, the drawings, the schedules is normally very prescriptive, and it's going to be just builders on site. So you don't mind too much beyond that. Contractors are also very good at providing costs, but they are rubbish at providing other technical information. But it's also why consultancy inputs are normally the other way around, because you want to know about who and how it's going to happen, not just the cost. The second point, frankly, a competitive cost should not be important to you. It's a false economy. It doesn't demonstrate value in its real, full sense. You should know your budget and work to that. Make sure people return sensible costs and demonstrate your value in other ways, social, environmental, service. My advice for construction contracts is that costs should be no more than 70%, and for consultancy contracts, scored at 5%. If the costs come back too high, you've got a failed tender process. But if you didn't have a failed tender process at this stage, you'd probably end up with a failed project later on. If they do come in too high, you can still select a preferred supplier and negotiate, or go for the closest three, review your requirements, or ask them to propose areas of saving. This is the one place that you do want to provide a template because you want these things to be really transparent and comparable. Test the template to death, make it really simple. We've got some examples that you can customize and share if you want them. Final thoughts. Okay, almost there. A couple of last things on evaluation panels and commenting and some wider big picture. And then my final on a deathbed, dear town clerk, please. So, evaluation panels, allow enough time and brief your moderators. Create a crib sheet before the tenders come back. Evaluation panels can be quite stressful. My first experience of one scared the shit out of me. I thought it was so obvious who's the best bid was, but I was the only one that saw it that way, and I had not prepared enough to fight back. We ended up with a really bad compromise, and the contract eventually failed. So prepare and make sure everyone is clear on the target. Comments. In that assessment panel, you're going to record comments. They need to be shareable with the bidders, normally the unsuccessful ones. So make them concise, link them to the scoring criteria, and if possible, be constructive and like layer up the shit sandwich. Like, don't just weigh in on the bad stuff. It makes everyone feel rubbish. If you want a few bits of work done, or you think you've got something going on that your neighbours might also be doing, then maybe procure it together. There are great economies of scale to be had. You might end up making a little panel of contractors or consultants for small things. This might enable you to lift a threshold of single sourcing works, which could save time. You want to measure bids for cost against rates rather than fixed fees for this. Think about what you can do in-house and importantly, how that might dovetail into the team that you're appointing. Okay, I'm going to wrap up in a minute. So I just wanted to recap. I've covered so much ground and not in full detail. You've no idea how long this talk could have been. If you've got any questions or you're starting something and you want to just talk it through, please get in touch. You can email me here. My last thoughts. I'm obviously a massive geek. But I do think procurement is fascinating. Like, how do you set out your ambitions in a way that you can find the right person to help you realize them? It is such a big, juicy, interpersonal, existential question. When we're responding to tenders, we spend 60% of the time pulling our hair out, trying to understand what's really needed here and how to give it in the best way. I hope you leave this presentation and write tenders that bring this hair pulling down to 40%. My final thoughts are be realistic about how likely your project is to proceed and how much you can afford and what you want. But be creative and courageous. Use this to set out your ambitions and ask people to respond to that. Think of unusual ways of scoring that technical side, a response to a really specific question, or real value added on something particular like social value. Be accessible and reach out. Preparing the best tender and getting the best responses is a massive effort. Be prepared to share your workings, discuss it with potential providers, invite people in to see what you're all about. It'll be reflected in what comes back to you. And keep communicating. The tender is step one. The response is step two. There might be another 30, 40, 200 steps beyond this once you're in contract. Be ready for them. Use a tender to set your expectations early. Okay, one more. No matter what you're looking to do, how small the job or the budget or your scale compared to bigger things, you still deserve great suppliers making great things to you. It is okay to be demanding about this. It brings everyone together. So I hope you can use what I've covered just now to do that for yourself, your communities, and get some flipping great projects going and going off on the right.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Tom. That was a great session. Had a few good questions there. So, stepping back now, considering the questions, your talk that you gave, is there one thing you would like your listeners really to remember? Kind of what is the headline takeaway from that session?
I think the main thing is you're not going to do a big procurement exercise that often. So don't worry about being a total expert in doing it. Go and, if you want to procure an architect, go and find a friendly local architect and just talk to them about the project and build that procurement method, that brief with them so that you get something that people can respond to really easily. Don't treat it like an exercise of all these forms you got to fill in. Make it a human exercise because it is the start of building a relationship that's probably going to last several years.
Yes, make it a human exercise. So you already back to you. We like to learn a lot about our guest speakers beyond the expertise they have. You already shared earlier that you were a magician in your younger years. I don't know if you were at 18, but
I was,
okay, so take me back to Tom at 18. Just describe Tom at 18 years old. What was he doing? Where was he at?
I
Yeah,
was
what was the
like
situation?
at 18, I was setting up a magic show at the Old Fire Station Theatre in Oxford with a friend. And we were preparing all of the acts and making all the props and designing all the sets. And then we put on the show. It was, I mean, I kind of, when I put that against me being 18, I feel so lucky that I was able to do that. And it was great. I mean, I wouldn't do it again, but it was great.
Now, so it was a one-off show or regular?
We'd done a show at our school, and then we'd had 2 weeks at the Old Fire Station in Oxford, and we
To
sold
try and
out.
make it commercial, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, I think we thought at 18 that's what you needed to do to be a
Yeah.
magician. You had to put on a show on
Yeah.
in a theatre. And it is an enormous amount of work.
Yeah.
It's like we spent 6 months making that show for 2 weeks. So it's and I think
Did you
there's
get
something
bums on
hard.
seats then?
We did. We hustled really hard. Like, we were out on the streets of Oxford in the run up to it every day, just doing street magic to try and get people to know about it, turn up and buy tickets. But the hard bit, though, is that you're not really, when you're on stage, you're performing a trick and it is going to go right. It's, even if you're pretending it's not, it's going to go right because you've got it perfect. And your relationship with the audience is very limited. You've got very bright lights in your face, you're
Yes.
quite disconnected. And that's a bit that I found I was disappointing in the end. Like, I loved then going on and doing close-up magic to people,
Close
and
up,
I
yeah,
loved
walking the tables, yeah.
just being, you get to feed off that
Yeah.
relationship. And in my work now, I love it. We do so much community engagement, and it's that ability to be in a room with people and work stuff out together. Like for me to bring a skill of drawing, but for them to bring knowledge and other skills and kind of pair them together.
So if you had to go up to your 18-year-old self, rushing around getting that show ready, and you had to like give them one little bit of advice, what advice would you give them? What
It's
to
quite
give young
hard because
Tom? Yeah.
I feel like I'm quite happy with where I am now. So I'd sort of say carry on. But I think I would try and tell myself to take the world a bit more seriously at that age. Like
Okay.
I think I missed out on stuff by kind of just living completely every day as it was and not really thinking about the bigger consequences of stuff. So yeah.
It's actually funny you say that. Julie, I think Julie King on the last guest, she was the opposite. Take it less seriously.
Yeah, right. That's
Anyway,
interesting, isn't it?
where every guest asks a question for the next guest. So your question from Julie King, it's a tough one. I have pre-warned you because
Yes.
such a tough one. So what piece of legislation would you change if you could and why?
Okay, mine's quite niche, but I've done a lot of research into the economies of land and housing. So my one is I would implement a land value capture mechanism on all public projects. And what that would mean is that, say, you own a house, but let me give you a real example. The Jubilee Line extension cost about £3 billion to build. The properties within a kilometre of each of those new stations, the aggregate uplift in value at completion of that line was 13 billion. But the only people who realised that value were the people who were lucky enough to own that land there in the first place. So everyone in the UK paid for the Jubilee Line extension. But the financial value was only realised by the people who live within a kilometre of the stations. And I think there's probably, well, I know there's a tweak that you could do to that system
Yeah.
that would mean that some of that value would get paid forward into other public projects.
That, yeah,
It's not a
solid
new
one.
idea. Winston
Yeah.
Churchill banged on about it right back
Right,
before he
okay.
was even a conservative. So it's been around for a while, but I think, you know, the time is right. In a world of inequality and slightly weird things to do with land ownership, this
Yeah.
would be a great thing to implement.
Nice one. I love that. Okay. And what was your question for the next guest speaker?
I would love to know if you could take one word from another language that really does heavy lifting in that language, or and add it to English, what would that word be?
Beautiful. That's going to be Jamie Charters from CCLA Investment Management, who's going to be
Okay.
asking that question. That's a perfect one for Jamie. Anyway, thanks again, Tom, for coming to join us today. Share your knowledge, answer those questions. Yeah, and have a really good